Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The Logan Library recently hosted a local Authors in Bloom event featuring Cache Valley writers. We're going to spotlight some of those writers today, get to know them a bit, learn about their books, talk about the joys and pitfalls of writing. Our guests will include Lauren Grace, M.G. Emerson, Melissa Lark, and Catherine V. Wolfe. Melissa Lark writes semi-funny romantic fiction with a touch of mystery. I'm getting this from Cache Valley Daily, our colleagues, so you can rebut this if you wish. I'll just read this. Her novels include Fresh Canvas, A Fresh Slate, and forthcoming entry in the series. Lauren Grace is the author of Love in the Valley, a historic novella set in Cache Valley. M.G. Emerson wrote the romance Shattered Reflections, and Catherine V. Wolfe wrote the eco-fantasy The Drum Tree. So we welcome in Melissa Lark. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you with us. Catherine V. Wolfe, thank you.
I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you. We also have with us M.J. Emerson. Ryan, you want to go by Ryan?
Yeah, okay. Ryan's great. Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about pen names as we go along. Thanks for joining us. And we have with us as well Lauren Grace.
A pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming in. This is a treat to have some authors with us. So let me start with Melissa. Tell me a bit about yourself, other than your books, kind of the Melissa the person.
For sure, Melissa the person. Oh, do we want to unpack that on the air? I am a mom of three, a wife, and I just believe that dogs are people, and that you should know that about me. If you can't pry a reading book out of my hand, I will be playing pickleball or I love camping, being outside, and karaoke.
All right. So. Yeah. Very cool. What do you read?
I love reading contemporary romantic fiction, the same kind of things that I write. I will dabble in mystery and suspense, but yeah, I go through novels like toilet paper.
Yeah. All right. Avid reader and writer.
Yes.
So Catherine V. Wolfe, tell me about yourself a little bit.
Well, I'm a New England native. Moved to Utah about a year and a half ago. My son-in-law, my daughter-in-law teach here at USU, and I came to be out here with their family. I have a grandson, 18 months old, just dropped him off down the street to the daycare. I taught for years, and when I finished teaching, I went back to a book that I'd written before I started, and that was The Drum Tree, and finished it up and got it out there.
So you'd started this years before?
Oh, yeah. My first notes from 1999.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we'll dive into that as soon as we go along. M.G. Emerson, Ryan.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about yourself.
Yep, I'm Ryan Tensmeyer. I grew up in Weber County. My wife and I got married in 2002, and we came up here to USU thinking we'd be here for a few years. And after graduating, got a job and have been established here for 20-plus years. We have six kids. We live in the North Logan area, and, we spend most of our time watching the things that they do and wishing that we still were more active. But, that's a lot of what we do is chase our kids around with their activities and – squeeze in some time for writing. I currently work at Space Dynamics Lab here as part of USU.
Yeah. So you squeeze writing in. It was probably a common refrain around the table. Let's hear from Lauren Grace next. Tell me about yourself.
I have lived in 10 states and several states of imagination. I am a mother of four. My youngest two are both students here at Utah State. One of them walked, but neither of them will graduate till December. And my first book was published a decade ago, and my 33rd will be published next month.
Wow. So, congratulations.
So I spend a lot of time writing. When I'm not writing, I am reading, or I live across the street from some lovely Highland cows that I imagine very funny conversations with.
I love talking to cows.
A lot of opportunity in Cache Valley. Yeah. Let's go in reverse order on the next question. Lauren, 33, did you say?
Yeah, books? 30, my 33rd novel will be published next month.
Yeah. So have to go back a ways, but how did you get into writing? What made you think you could take the leap? I guess some people think about it, but a smaller subset of people actually do it?
So the first book I wrote was the 70s when I was in third grade. And I call it the mostly plagiarized version of Little House on the Prairie. Obviously never published. But it was later in school that we figured out that I had a learning disability called dysgraphia, which means, as Mark Twain said, he probably can't say it the way he did, but I am one of those souls who cannot spell the same word the same way twice. So it wasn't until about 10 years ago that I finally decided to take the leap and get a really good editor and get one of my books out there, because I literally can't tell if I've written Untied or United, which gets entertaining.
It makes a difference, yeah. I guess it from time to time it could spark some creativity if you wrote the wrong word and it turns out to be a good creative choice. A good editor would be very needed.
Didn't have them edit my blurb that I put on Amazon for my first book. So the first book said, Lucy dreamed of marring Samuel, which turned that romance into a horror.
I guess you could just go with it at that point, right? Yeah. Yeah. So what genre do you write in?
I write romance to warm the heart or kissing books. I write both historical and contemporary. My first book, Waking Lucy, was mostly written in the North Logan Library, and currently I'm writing Regency historicals with a little bit of suspense in them.
Yeah, very good. And there are a lot of very specific subgenres, right?
Yeah.
I've become familiar with this, spice level for one thing, there's clean and sweet, all that. So Regency, so you're just getting into Regency.
So, I outlined this series probably 8 years ago, and then I ended up writing some billionaire books and some bodyguard books and got in the rom-com contemporary world, and I'm so excited to actually be back to the historicals where I started. My first set was American historicals, which is awesome since it's the 250th anniversary, and they tie into what life was like in colonial America.
Yeah, yeah. So Melissa said she devours these romances, right?
Right. I do very much.
Yeah. I'll come back to you, but Lauren, do you read in this genre? Do you get tips or ideas?
I read a lot of romance. I still love to read a lot of sci-fi and fantasy, although I don't feel equal to letting the ones that are on my computer out of my computer in those genres. And then I do read a decent amount of nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me skip right back to you, Melissa, because you said you read voraciously in this genre. I guess that could be good or bad, right? You could get ideas maybe, but as you read a bunch of books and you see, oh, that idea's already taken, or that idea's, do you have that problem?
Yeah, I do. It's interesting because I've been attending a critique group with Lauren for, quite some time now, and it's difficult sometimes to turn off your author brain and turn back on your reading brain, and that it's difficult sometimes, and it takes a very specific type of author to be able to transcend my critique brain and just let me enjoy the story. So I found my select few of authors that I can enjoy from, and they have vast backlists, which is fantastic for me. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to do that. But yeah, it almost is kind of my break from my writing brain, because I still love words. I still love story so much that I'm able to enjoy and like celebrate other people's work. And then also it helps with understanding the market and understanding kind of where your own works of progress would fit into the market. And that's kind of also how I understand, like, for my next series, I'm not going to divulge anything on the air, but for my next series, like, finding those niches in the market that might not be as tired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you were described, and I read this, semi-funny romantic fiction with a touch of mystery.
Yes.
The only one I would take if I were your except to is semi-funny.
Semi-funny is self-funny. Yes, okay. I'm still working toward the fully funny.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's self-proclaimed semi-funny. But,
okay. All right.
You know, it's just my touch of sarcasm that you'll find running rampant in my books.
All right. Very good. Well, let me ask you, how did you get into writing?
Oh, you know what? I want to say I'm a survivor of a quarter-life crisis, and I don't know if that's a thing, but I'm making it a thing. Mm. But just, I've always loved words. I've been reading since I was, you know, very young. My mom taught me. She's the best ever. But anyway, so I was able to reconnect with some hobbies after having my children. So with motherhood, this is a very, very prevalent topic, actually, in my debut series, Fresh Canvas. And but losing yourself through motherhood and your identity, you really have to sacrifice a lot of parts of yourself to raise your children, as you should. But after that, it's kind of you're left with your head in your hands, like, who even am I? Mm-hmm. And so I was able to reconnect with writing, and I learned so much through years of therapy and just finding this joy and this spark in myself that I was like, I want to share this message with other women, with other moms, especially even in my own life. I've heard the same narrative over and over again with these young mothers that I wanted to create a voice and, of course, you know, add in some mysterious art heists and a hot Italian guy because I could and create a series that's very validating, but then also sharing my own experience of reclaiming my own hobbies and passions as a young mother.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned therapy, and I don't want to trivialize this, but I've heard some writers say that writing can be like therapy.
Oh, very much so. I mean, it's the same concept as journaling, which many therapists will advise you to do. Mm. But being able to pour your own emotions, and I mean, granted, there's you know plenty of circumstance in Fresh Canvas, for example, that does not that I've never experienced, but as a human who experiences the whole spectrum of human emotion, you're able to really identify and relate to these characters and pour your own griefs or insecurities or even your happiness like onto the page in a certain way that makes it believable, but also very satisfying and validating for readers.
Yeah, yeah. We'll come back to each of you to talk a little bit specifically about a latest book, you know, kind of a thing. Well, I've skipped around, so we'll come last to you, Ryan. Let's go next to Catherine. You mentioned decades ago you wrote notes for this book. Did you know that was going to become a book?
It just grew. It was like doing a tapestry, you know, like weaving. And I had a period of time between when my kids started like kindergarten, first grade, and they were out of the house a little bit, and before I actually started to teach, where I was home. And those first notes started to just weave themselves into a story, which I have like handwritten whole chapters that were written decades ago. But I didn't submit this particular book until a year and a half ago. So, yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Now, that takes a certain amount of courage to say, or chutzpah, or I don't know what you call it, to say, hey, I think this is good enough to be published.
Well, when you've worked on something that long.
Yeah.
I actually had a whole manuscript for what will hopefully be a second novel in the series, also written way back then and has woven itself out. Since this book was submitted, and it was a leap of faith, for sure. I wanted a publisher. I didn't really understand the world of self-publishing, which some of you seem to understand so well. So I sent it out there, and to a publisher that a friend of mine had published with, frankly, and they knew his name and they took it in and were willing to read it for me. Yeah.
We'll talk about that, self-publishing versus having a publisher.
Yeah.
It's a whole world out there, right? Yeah. All right, let's turn to Ryan. What got you into writing?
Yeah, so I actually have a kind of a similar story that the book that I just most recently published, it was one that I started when I was 14 years old. I got into the Lord of the Rings series, and I just loved the fantasy books. And so I started the summer between my 8th and 9th grade year, I'd set a goal to write 5 or 10 pages a day. And so I started just writing. And it's kind of funny, if I go back and look at that original manuscript, I didn't have a destination in mind at that point. I just, as thoughts came into my mind, I would write those up each day. And I remember there was even a point in the book where my character, he traveled out somewhere, and I was like, oh, I forgot that I wanted to do this. And so we had to turn around and go back to a different city to do something. But yeah, it's kind of a fun adventure that way. But then the book that I actually self-published most recently last year, Shattered Reflections, it was one that I hadn't thought about long. I had a dream one night and I woke up and thought, oh, that was a off-the-wall dream. Something like that could never happen. And then I thought, I wonder if it could happen. So I started to research it, and I realized that it was some emotional trauma that really could happen to somebody. And so I started to think how I could make it into a story. And I wondered if it was something that could come to life. And yeah, started putting together chapter one, and little by little it turned into a story, and yeah, started to get to the point that it was ready to publish.
I guess you got to start and then keep going, right?
That's yeah.
How do you, I guess any of you can answer, I'll start with Ryan on this. How do you, I guess you have to feel that it's good, right? To keep going, but how do you know you're just not deluded?
Yeah. And it's kind of funny, just yesterday I do have Shattered Reflections on Audible, and just yesterday I was in my car, and it was the book that popped up on my playlist, and so it started playing, and there are parts that even yesterday it started making my eyes water up a little bit hearing it, and then there are other parts I'm like, oh, I wish I would have worded that just a little bit different. And so there's always that worry that you throw something out there, and you know, not only are other people going to be happy with what you've done, but am I happy with the finished product? So there is that back and forth wondering,
yeah,
should I let it go?
Right. Should you? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Anybody else want to tackle that? It takes a bit of courage to say, hey, I think this is good.
It does. And I think that courage starts as delusion very far earlier in the writing process. And I mean, I've been attending, again, what I said, a critique group for a while now, and you really want to be able to find a community of writers that you can rely on to tell you that, hey, this really sucked, this was really bad. Mm-hmm. And because then that you're able to learn from it, and you're able to learn from critiquing other people's work as well, and it really does shape you to have a more critical eye. And then you notice, like, oh, like as you're producing these new chapters after you've learned so much, it's the quality of work just gets better and better. And so I feel like as long as you have that group, that outside voice of reason sometimes, because you can get so into your own head of like, oh, this is awesome, or oh, maybe this is crap, and then you give it to somebody else and they really liked it. And you're able to kind of gauge and see yourself, because, you know, sometimes even like if you're a painter, like sometimes you get so close to the canvas, so close to the art project that you don't know if you just want to throw it all away sometimes. But it really does take a community of people that you can rely on to be able to survive the producing and the publishing industry.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, I wonder about, because you worked on this for years.
Well, I did.
Yeah.
And I've been interesting. It's been interesting lately because I've been seeing reviews. I mean, people write in reviews and they've been good. And I read them. I'm like, oh, I didn't think of it that way. I didn't see it that way. But I had many people read this book, obviously, over a very long period of time. But the book that it's following up from is very outlandish. Like, it goes places that I've never read in a book, and I'm waiting for feedback on that book, and I'm like, I don't know, this could be just terrible. And I don't know, I'm waiting, because for me, it says what I want to say. It's getting my point out into the world. I'm an ecologist, and there's stuff there that I want to say, but does anybody want to read that? I have no idea.
Yeah. On tenterhooks here a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
So, Lauren, I guess this ship has sailed in part. 30 books, right? You've established a readership, but there must have been a point where you, or is it every book that you think?
Imposter syndrome never truly leaves, and I know when I start hating the book I'm writing, that's the time to send it off to the developmental editor to get some feedback on what's going right and what's going wrong. The other day I was coaching a young writer. She's just graduating from high school. And unfortunately, the first person to have read her book outside of her family was a former university professor who was rather harsh. And I'm like, she doesn't even have this done yet. Until she gets all of that sand in the sandbox and can start editing and making it from just a pile into a beautiful castle, it's not the time to critique her and say her stuff is terrible. So getting that sand in that sandbox and then getting some feedback, and when you hate it, set it aside, because there likely may be one or two problems, but the other 97% is really awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it does help to get feedback, right? Like yeah. you said, or you guys are in a critique group together, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's take a break. Much more to talk about. We're talking with some Cache Valley authors. They were participated in the Local Authors in Bloom event recently at the Logan Library. And we are talking with Lauren Grace, MJ Emerson, Melissa Lark, and Catherine B. Wolf. Pen names, but I'm very curious to talk about that following a break. We'll get some advice for up-and-coming writers as well. We'll have you talk about some specific books as we go along as well. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are piggybacking on a recent event from the Logan Library. They recently hosted a Local Authors in Bloom event featuring Cache Valley writers. We were spotlighting some of those writers today. Great to have some writers in the studio. We're getting to know them a bit, learning about their books, talking about the joys and pitfalls of writing. Our guests include Lauren Grace, MJ Emerson, Melissa Lark, and Catherine B. Wolf. These are pen names. Some kind of close to your regular name, but I want to start here with Ryan. So MJ Emerson, I'll just ask you why the pen name?
Yeah. And mine isn't over complicated. I actually got to the point that my book was about finished and I was ready to put it out there. And I started thinking who my audience would be in particular as I released it, as some of the marketing techniques would start happening. And I realized more than anything, I thought that this book would appeal to like adult women. And I thought, well, they might not want me to come in and to be the male authority mansplaining my point of view on any of these topics. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just pick a gender neutral name. And so I started just thinking of some names that would have a good ring to them, that would blow off your tongue easy, I guess. And MJ Emerson is where I landed. And it's been kind of interesting to talk to different people. I think my mom in particular would like to see my name on mm-hmm. on my book. She mm-hmm. seems to be my biggest fan. But yeah, that's my biggest thing, is I just wanted mm-hmm. to let people judge the book for the content rather than who wrote it initially.
Do people show up at the book signing and seem disappointed?
I haven't done a lot of book signings. Yeah. So I think, that the one we did at the library was my first public event. Most of the people that I've known and have actually been friends and family, I think that it's gone a little outside of that. But it hasn't been a detriment one way or the other.
And that is interesting. I don't, as I look at the, the romance, I haven't read every last romance book, obviously, but I've read some, and I don't see men. Maybe there are men like you that are under pen names.
Yeah, and I think, romance probably isn't the right title for this book. It's more of an emotional drama, I would say, on this one. But yeah, I think the main characters are women, and it kind of follows their emotional journey as they go through some significant loss together. And yeah, I think that, just was one of those things that I think, I think women would appreciate this mostly, but it's been well received by both sides.
Yeah. So Melissa, you write romance, essentially.
Yes.
That's the genre, it's subgenres.
I was going to say it's mainly women's fiction, because like Ryan, mm-hmm. my my genre focuses on the woman's journey. Granted, there are all of my favorite romance tropes and mystery and other things compiled onto that. But the overall message is the woman's growth arc as she, you know, figures things out for herself.
Yeah. So as you're writing this, do you have in mind women readers mostly?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. I feel like with women's fiction and with the types of kind of social constructs I like to address, like, for example, in my first debut novel, Fresh Canvas, I address mom guilt, which is just, you know, very prevalent in every woman's life that has a child. And then, you know, my second book, Fresh Start, in the series, Fresh Start, really unpacks what it feels like to be, you know, to have a lot of societal pressures on how you should behave or act or perform, or, you know, different benchmarks that you need to meet at certain points in your life. And those social constructs are addressed in that. So I do go into every one of my books with like a point or a message that I want to get across to women. And that really helps guide the narrative and the story.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, I wonder, do you, of course, all of you would like everyone to read your book, right? But,
of course.
But do you have an audience in mind when you're writing?
Well, people have asked me if it's a young adult novel, because it's four of the main characters are teenagers and there's a coming of age element to it. But I would really like everybody to read it, because I want everybody, it's about coming to love the planet, and I want all of us to love the planet. I'm hoping that people will come to, it's a lot of forest time. So people who enjoy being in the forest, who enjoy nature, who enjoy adventure and quests, there's a certain quest element to it. But it's not tagged as young adult. I would tag it as like 15 to 18 and then adult. Readers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess same question to you, Lauren. What do you, maybe depends on the book, but do you have an audience in mind?
I don't think I write for the audience as much as I write for myself, but I also, I'm a member of my own audience. And so that makes it a little bit different. On occasion, I've written a book literally because I've received a letter saying, I love this character in that book. Will you write a book about that character? And so I'm like, you know what? I was thinking about it anyway. If my reader wants it, sure. So I think that's pretty much where it goes. I like building book series around a strong family. There can be some really terrible characters in there and things to overcome. But the thought, for some of us, even a fantasy, that there can be a strong family with grandparents that could be looked up to is something I like to include.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They say write what you know, right? And obviously your own experience is going to, I'll start with Ryan on this one, your own experience is going to come through, but are there times when it's just a total leap and that's just, you know, you find yourself writing what you didn't think you knew?
Yeah, I mean, in this case, I guess where I did have women as my audience, I had to be sensitive to that. And a lot of what I put into the book was things that I, characteristics that I saw in my wife, as she's kind of the second main character in this book is who I imagine that character after. And just kind of, you know, a lot of times you see the women kind of put themselves on the, a little bit, they have to put other people first, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And so I tried to kind of incorporate that into this book, and I kind of have a similar idea that I would like to do kind of a flip side of that book and show from her perspective that, you know what, there were a lot of struggles that she was going through that other people didn't see as she was supporting her friend. And yeah, that's something that, for sure, I'm not an expert in, but just from observation and trying to get feedback of how different people would respond.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, you said there's some leaps. In your next book, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, the book that is out now is called The Drum Tree, and it's a very set in a very small environment, a village and a nearby forest and another village. It's a sort of Earth equivalent world, but it's in this small area, and there's some magical realism that comes into that. But the second book travels out into time, into space. It really reaches sort of even towards the beginning of where we all came from. And so there's a lot of leaps there. And I can take those leaps in my writing, but yeah, the question is, will readers take those leaps? And that book will be called High Ledges, and hoping to get that out in the next year or so.
All right, yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say on this?
Oh, man. Yeah, there's definitely some reaching and a lot of research goes along with that. My entire series takes place in an art museum, and my main characters are art curators. And that is a very difficult profession, and you know, the ins and outs of the workings of behind the museum and the staff, and to see how all of those things work, especially when it comes to taking care of, you know, priceless artifacts and those things. So there was a lot that I didn't know that I had to research and learn about. So yes, there was a lot of reaching, but it's made for a very satisfying reader experience.
So, Lauren, one of your—I'm reading here, your latest or one of the latest novellas set in historical times?
So the one that the Cache Valley Daily highlighted is called Love in the Valley, and it is set at the little schoolhouse that's just a mile north of here in 1900. My imagination of what a teacher here in Cache Valley might have experienced in 1890. I did so much research. I know some of the most bizarre facts about Cache Valley, from things like which house has 18 inch thick walls built from stone from the temple quarry, and, you know, just little teeny things that I could find out and put in, where the railroad ran and where, you know, what teamsters came down from where, and all of these things, so I could make her world real. My favorite person that I got to meet, who's a real person, I didn't meet her technically since she's dead, is Ida Ione Cook, who was here at the Brigham Young Academy, which is the forerunner of this university. And to learn about her life was absolutely amazing. And so we stuck as much as we could in the book about her, even though the book was about a fictional character. So I love the research.
Yeah. Well, let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with our Cache Valley authors. They recently participated in an event at the Logan Library called Local Authors in Bloom. We have some of those authors with us today: Lauren Grace, M.J. Emerson, Melissa Lark, and Catherine V. Wolfe. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking to some Cache Valley writers. They were recently spotlighted at the Logan Library, an event there called Local Authors in Bloom. So we're shining spotlight on them today. We're talking with Lauren Grace, M.J. Emerson, Melissa Lark, and Catherine V. Wolfe. These are pen names, but they're in studio with us today. I want to talk about process. I'll start with Melissa. We'll just go around the table. Tell me about your process. One example, I've had writers tell me that you create a character, but then they take on a life of their own, and then they inform you. Does that happen to you?
Oh, they do. And it's so difficult to explain because, you know, in all intents and purposes, these are imaginary friends in your brain, and they should not be able to dictate such stories, but they do. And but yeah, I think whenever you let your stories be very character-driven, and you understand your character's motives and what they want, and, you know, what regrets or haunts that they have, you could plop them into any scene, and they could, you know, you would understand how they would act and behave in that scene. And yeah, having it such a character-driven series like the Fresh series, there was this one scene I was writing, And Fresh Canvas is an enemies to lovers trope. And so, you know, they very, very much hate each other at the beginning of the book. And I had this, you know, this scene where I had it planned and these two characters were going to have kind of a softer reconciliation type moment. And out of my own fingertips, as I'm typing, they begin to argue. And I was like so frustrated. But again, it's my autonomy. It's my body creating this scene. And I just found that so ironic that, you know, they completely hijacked the scene. But it made it so much better. And I understood their character intentions. Like, it's like I was trying to force them into a narrative that wasn't authentic to who I've created these characters to be. So, yeah, things like that will happen. And then also there was this one moment towards the end of the book where all of a sudden one tiny little detail quirk that I assigned one of the characters came forth as an explanation for like her entire how she lived her life and her view on the world. And I did not plan that quirky detail to be have such weight because I thought, oh, this would be kind of fun to write about. And it completely tied it in a way where, you know, it made me look very smart. It made me look very, very talented as an author. But no, it just organically happened. So your process, yes, it can definitely get hijacked. And I would say another part of my process is, you know, you have those intrusive thoughts. And what happened if they won? Like, what happened if this happened? And letting, you know, different types of you know, errant ideas and letting them go and see where they go. And sometimes my best writing is those most unhinged type scenes.
Catherine, tell me about your process.
Well, there are some very strong similarities. I'll start on a scene, start in a place, start with the characters that I want to be there, and they will start talking to each other. I did a blog post recently where if you were looking into my office when I'm writing, I might be just sitting there like this. And it's all happening, and then it'll all come out in a rush. They're telling me what they want to say. They're having their conversations. And then it will all just spill out. A lot of my writing, though, is not conversation. It's setting, set and setting. Mm-hmm. And I spend a lot of time in that kind of description. Mm-hmm. And there, too, I have to see it. So I have to be in that place. And I have to be writing from within the smells and sights and colors and wind and what is touching a character in that environment. So that's a lot of that process. And a lot of it is just scribbling. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And picking up and picking out parts of the scribbles that seem to make sense with what I'm working on in that moment.
Yeah. Do you, I guess any of you, do you have to get a first draft out, mm-hmm. and then it's a lot of editing? Is that
Well, when I turned this book into my editor, before they would get into the nitty gritty editing, they wanted me to take out 20,000 words.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was a real process of honing in on what was necessary to the story and what was extraneous, potentially, that was part of my background for the story, but didn't need to be there for the reader. And I learned a lot doing that about efficiency in writing. It's still not a short book, but it's 20,000 words less. And I enjoyed that process, even though it was hard.
Ryan, tell me about your process.
Yeah, something is these two are talking that I thought about is just with the character development is when I'm reading a book, when I'm writing a book, it really bugs me if it just this character has brown hair and brown eyes. I want to know what they look like. And so a lot of times when I'm reading a book, I'll go out to the internet and be like, okay, what actor would I make? What actor would I pick for this character? Just so I can have a person associated with that. And with my books, part of the fun part that I do is I've used some AI tools. I'll generate images of my characters and I'm like, okay, now that person has a face for me. And then I can start, you know, building around that. A lot of times the what we think about people is our first impressions is what we see. And so I think that for me, I need to see a person before I do it. I know a lot of people are able to just do that in their imagination, but that's my process. And then similar to what Catherine was saying, I don't have deadlines, and there are times that I don't necessarily sit at a desk, but I'll just be you know, my wife will be say, "Oh, what are you thinking about?" And I'm off in my nothing box thinking about, okay, I want my character to get to this point in the book. How am I going to get them to that point? And so it's a lot of just as I'm doing nothing, I'm thinking about these characters. You've got these books in your head already, like was mentioned, and you're trying to create experiences for them to put that message out there that you want to get out.
Mm. Lauren, tell me about your process.
In the writing world, we have plotters, who are people who outline a lot, and pantsers, who fly by the seat of their pants. Mm. I have co-written with a plotter who writes 20,000-word outlines. My outline tends to be 100 words and a doodle on a whiteboard. And so even though because most of the classes that you'll take are how to plot, because no one can teach you how to fly by the seat of your pants. I thought for a while I had to plot, and it was the worst thing in the world. Now I'm to the point, I'm like, I have a loose calendar of events. I know what day they're going to meet or re-meet, what day they're, you know, probably going to have a first kiss, although the Duke just got put in timeout because of his first kiss. and, you know, when it's going to end. And I just kind of go off of that calendar of events, knowing that my highs and lows and my pullbacks and when their worst day ever is going to be and is going to happen along that without a very huge outline. So, and I usually get surprised in the end. I knew exactly where this last book was going to go, and the last chapter is nowhere near what I thought it would be.
That's interesting, yeah. Well, just a couple minutes left. I just want to do a rapid fire around the last question, which is advice. What's your top piece of advice for aspiring writer?
Oh, you know what? I'll raise you one. So my first piece of advice is to just be a reader. Be a reader, understand the market, understand, and especially as a young, you know, teen or kid, if you want to grow up to be a writer, make sure that you're digesting those words, because those words will then, you know, your vocabulary will expand, and writing down the line, like, you will have a better literary purging, if you will, because you'll have those words already kind of ingrained in you. And second, if you are already writing or you're considering writing, find your community, find your people, find the people that you can, you know, pass on a chapter to whenever you're feeling stuck, and you can let them know, hey, I just need a cheerleader right now, and they'll be there for you. Because writing itself is a very solitary type job, and it can get very lonely. And I feel like if you do not have your community of other people who also understand what it's like to just hallucinate on a daily level, like what Ryan said, just where you're constantly off in no man's land, it can be a difficult process. So as long as they are, you have people that will critique your work, tell you it stinks when it stinks, like that's the way that you're going to be able to get to the final holding your book in your hands moment.
All right. Catherine, one piece of advice.
Don't be scared of the blank page. Okay. Just get some words down, write every day, write when you can. And just write.
Yeah, just write. Yeah, good piece of advice. Yeah. Ryan, what about you?
Yeah, my thought is have the audience in mind, but at the same time, don't worry too much about their feedback. There are going to be some people that love it. There are going to be some people that don't think so much of it. But yeah, just write what you feel and be willing to make people happy and disappoint a few people at the same time.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Don't edit until you're done with the draft. I know so many, only 2% of all people who start writing a book finish the book. And so many get stuck in trying to make chapter one perfect. Wait till you're done with chapter 30 before you go back and look at chapter one.
Yeah, very good. Well, we've been talking with some Cache Valley authors, and go and check out their books for sure. We've been talking with Lauren Grace. Thank you so much. MG Emerson, Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Melissa Lark, thank you.
Glad to be here.
And Catherine B. Wolf, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's One Sky, Many Cultures. Skywatcher Leo T with you. There's been a whole lot of shaking going on in our local solar system lately, and there's always something exciting to look at and soak up. After this actually somewhat wet season that is trembling on the edge of beauty all the time, stunning during the day hours and at dusk as well, as we can watch the crescent moon dance with the planets as Bella Luna returns this week. On Tuesday, the crescent hung between Venus and Jupiter in a spectacular scene. And then by 10:55 p.m. later that night, the whole sky had moved westward, of course. Castor and Pollux, the crescent and the Jupiter formed a celestial bow, shooting an invisible arrow to the northwest. Checked out the silver moon, or rather the sliver of a silver moon, in my binoculars, and the craters look like they're about 10 miles away. So even a few days later, enjoy this scene as it evolves. And of course, on Monday, a somewhat close call for Earthlings as asteroid 2026 JH2 came within 57,000 miles of our planet. Thanks to an article from NBC News and Denise Chow and other sources, the asteroid discovered just a few days ago is about 62 feet wide and as long as a blue whale or a basketball court. I like those comparisons. Anyway, it careened near the Earth on Monday. Again, 57,000 miles from Earth is an eyelash, cosmically speaking. For scope, the distance to the moon is on average about 238,855 miles from Earth. It was discovered May 10th by astronomers at the Mount Lemmon Survey, an astronomical project based in Arizona's beautiful Santa Catalina Mountains, as well as the Far Point Observatory in Kansas and a couple others. It's rare for an object of this size to make such a close flyby of Earth, though not unprecedented, and NASA's keeping an eye on another one that's going to be coming in here in April 13th, 2029, because it's about 1,200 feet and should be coming into around 20,000 miles of Earth, or that's what's projected is about 20,000 miles from Earth. So NASA's OSIRIS APEX probe is going to rendezvous with Apophis on June 2029 to study how close the flyby of Earth affects the space rock's orbit and physical properties. In other words, Earth is a great big orb with a lot of gravity in the sky, and OSIRIS hopes to discover how the Earth's gravity will affect the flyby, and hopefully the wind's not blowing the wrong way. The mission was designed as a follow-up to OSIRIS-REx mission that collected the first ever samples from an asteroid and returned them to Earth in 2023 and went back out. The probe has been operating in space since it launched in 2016, but the administration's budget request for fiscal 2027 would end the mission before the asteroid rendezvous, part of sweeping cuts proposed for NASA. The White House proposal is enacted. OSIRIS-APEX would be among more than 50 missions canceled. I think we need that one, anyway. And as we look into how different cultures from different geographic locations interpret constellations, stars, and star lore, this episode we'll check out a legend from the plains, tribes, or nations. This legend is a creation myth noted in a book titled Sky Wolf's Calls by Eldon Yellowhorn and Kathy Loniger from the Blackfoot in Canada. By the way, they're called the Blackfeet in Montana and the Blackfoot in Canada, according to this literature. And there's a little bit of an intro from George Byrne Grinnell. The Blackfoot believe that the sun made the earth, that he is the creator. One of the names by which they call the sun is Napi, or old man. This is how they tell of the creation. In the beginning, water was everywhere. Nothing else could be seen. Something was floating on the water, and Napi and all the animals were adrift on a raft. Napi wished to make land, and he told the muskrat to dive down into the bottom of the water and try to bring up a little mud. He dived down and was underwater a long time, but could not reach the bottom. Then the loon tried, and after him the otter, but the water was too deep for them to reach the bottom. At last the beaver was sent down, and he was gone for a long, long time, so long that they thought he must have drowned. But at last he came up and floated almost dead on the water, and when they pulled him up on the raft and looked at his paws, they found a little mud clutched in one of his paws. Napi restored beaver's life by sharing the spirit of breath. Then he took the mud, rolled it between his hands, and threw it back into the water. It did not sink. Instead, it grew larger until they could step onto solid ground. That was the beginning of ground. Grateful Napi made Beaver the chief of the water people and gave him the power to control the flow of the water. So look around, look up, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.
This is Science by the Slice. He's a very outgoing cat. All life on Earth depends on enzymes. These natural proteins act as catalysts to hasten chemical reactions. Carbon-nitrogen bond formation is among catalytic-dependent processes needed to enable cycling of nitrogen through ecosystems and sustain plant and animal life. Often, Mother Nature needs a boost with human-made synthetic catalysts to supplement our global demand for food, energy, and pharmaceutical production. USU chemists Yi Rao and Jesse Brown are studying environmentally friendly copper-based catalysts that are less reliant on fossil-based fuels.
This segment of Science by the Slice is brought to you by the USU College of Arts and Sciences, offering degree programs in the sciences and mathematics. Details at artsci.usu.edu.
Hi, this is Steve Williams, and every Sunday evening you can tune in for a selection of jazz music from the Jazz Time with Steve Williams Archives. Geez, I've got a lot of great music for you. Frank Vignol and those guys got some Stefan Grappelli, and I've got a tribute to Eddie South. That's Sunday from 6 to 10 p.m. here on Utah Public Radio.
Support for programming here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members, and UPR is made possible today with a program day sponsorship, remembering Logan resident Ron Shaw today on his birthday.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide listener-supported